It is National Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom.com. And now I know I've been talking about this for more than a month, but so many of you are starting businesses right now. So LegalZoom has decided to extend this through March. Call it whatever you want. Just remember, it is a great time to start a business. I've actually done it through these guys. Whether you're setting up an LLC, S-Corp, sole proprietorship, or nonprofit, LegalZoom takes care of you from start to finish. The services are great. These award-winning services were developed by the best legal minds in the country, and every business will get personalized attention and, by the way, notifications. They look after you even after you've set the business up. This is why over 90% of LegalZoom customers would recommend the service to their family members. I got to say, I'm actually amongst those guys. You will be in good company. 36 companies on the Inc. 500 list were started through LegalZoom. Start your business right at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm and provides self-help services at your specific direction, but there is so much more. Now, every LLC and incorporation package includes easy-to-use business accounting software, a $269 value, free. Be sure to enter Drew in the referral box at checkout. Start your business, protect your family, and safeguard your assets at LegalZoom.com today.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome. It's the Dr. Drew Podcast. Today we welcome Anna David. I don't know where to start with your pedigree, Anna. AnnaDavid.com, at Anna David. There will be a link on this episode's page. Was it the link, they like me, they really like me? Is that what we're going to link to?
Right.
Okay.
Awesome.
It is they like me, they really like me. It's available now on Amazon.com. Click through the Amazon banner at DrDrew.com. Examines the relationship between fame and those that consume it, I'd say, and those that drive to be around it.
Those who are obsessed with it.
Well, not just obsessed with it, though, because when you say obsessed with it, it almost sounds like people that like read magazines about
right.
like Teen Beat or something, like the old movie.
And you better
magazine.
Believe I read those.
But you read like people like everybody else does, though.
Right. I mean, this was right. obsession taken to a very extreme degree, I
right.
would say.
Talk to me about that.
So, okay. When I first moved to L.A., I worked at People magazine. And I sort
And already was that because you wanted to be around and meet and to write about?
100%. Yes.
The reason I keep backing away from what you're saying is I feel like so many people do at least a version of what you're describing. Like
yeah.
most people, most women particularly,
right.
do some version of this. Were you just an extreme version of what everyone does? Or were you something else?
I think so. I mean, my family's not like this. My family, they've all got PhDs. They're all very literary. I was into reading Teen Beat and remember 16 magazine, and I was obsessed with like Tom Howell and Rob Lowe. But rather than sort of keeping it where it should have been, maybe, I was like, oh, well, I will go to LA and I will date. Like, I figured I would marry C. Thomas Howell because he was in The Outsiders and I loved him so much.
Where did you come from? Where were you?
Marin County, up north. So I cannot really blame my parents for this. I was just a pop culture obsessed kid. And I agree with you that it's even more prevalent now. People were into it. But I was, yeah, I assumed, you know, I went and I got a degree in English and I wanted to write for magazines. But my sole goal was to interview celebrities. It never occurred to me that somebody would say, want to write about politics.
But there's a difference between wanting to go report celebrity and be a part of that product. You know what I mean? It's celebrity's
well,
a product versus I want to go date one, have sex with one, that kind of thing.
I think that a lot of the people who do celebrity profiling do it for not because they think it's just such an important cultural phenomenon to explore, but they've got something in them that's driving them to be so consumed by, you know, fame is the most powerful commodity we have today. Forget money. Fame is the power.
Yeah.
And it's so fleeting. It's so sort of impossible to put your finger on.
Certainly today, it just whew,
yeah.
goes and comes. But it's intoxicating in some way.
It certainly was to me. And I think, you know, so I went to college in Connecticut. I dated a boy. He was an aspiring actor. He really thought he was going to be a movie star. His name was Matt Damon. I never expected him to become what he is, ever. But I think that that's wonderful. And he's super talented. And I certainly haven't talked to him in a long time. But I think it did something funny to my brain at the same time that sort of my addiction was really, you know, I believe I was born an alcoholic and I was.
But you were going, you had enough delay gratification to be able to go to college and get an education. Was that just because your family was so into that?
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't even, you know, upwardly mobile Jews. Like they were not going to not let me do that.
Right. You couldn't have run away to Hollywood at 14
no.
or 17 or 19.
I remember my mom and I had this conversation when we were, I have no talent as an actress. It's just a fact. And I remember talking to my mom when I was a teenager and I said, if you guys didn't have expectations of me, I would just go to Hollywood. But I mean, thank God I'm somewhat talent free in the acting
and you're going to be an actor.
I didn't matter. It was
be
like
famous.
It
be
just
famous.
Yeah, it was just to be around it.
Oh,
know?
Yeah.
And so then, you know, I date this boy. He ends up becoming, you know, the biggest superstar. Suddenly, literally, it felt like overnight. I was actually already working at People when that happened.
And you were how old?
Well, I dated him my senior year in college. It would have been his senior year, but he was on leave from Harvard making this movie School Ties. So,
are you at Harvard at the time?
No, I went to Trinity.
Trinity College.
And it was an hour and a half away, and I had a Harvard fetish, and all my boyfriends went to Harvard. So I start working at People, and I start telling them, oh, my boyfriend from college is going to be this big star. Everyone's like, yeah, everybody's ex-boyfriend is going to be a big star. And then it literally happens, you know, that Goodwill Hunting comes out when I'm still working at People.
And do you figure you've got some special insight or power
not
at that point?
Not only that. No, I figured I had the ability to find stars.
I
was just like, oh, my God, you know, I can call it. And you know, and so he and I drifted apart. You know, nothing bad at all. He became a superstar, you know. And I think that something twisted happened in my brain where I literally was like, rather than sort of, first of all, seeing that as like the culmination of his great talent and his great success, I was so narcissistic that I really saw it as almost a betrayal. Like, how did he do this and not take me with him? You know, I'm not even kidding.
Or at least give you, as he was at the podium, the nod. Thank you for, Anna David, for giving me what I needed to be a
Whatever.
Great star.
And the character that he named the love interest after in Good Will Hunting was the girl he dated after me. So it's like, I was like, where? I've been erased, you know? And I really was that narcissistic. Like,
well, let's talk about that relationship between narcissism and fame.
Yeah.
What is that relationship?
Well, I mean, your book, remember that?
Oh, I know my book, yes.
The studies about, I that always stuck with me, that when you did those narcissism studies, it was the reality stars that were the most narcissistic.
By far, particularly the female reality shows, interestingly. And when you think about it, I mean, somebody has to be motivated to and then fight their way onto one of those shows and then be an asshole on one of those shows. Why? Because it's me.
Right.
Because me, man. What? Right. Of course you're going to want to watch because, hey, it's me.
Right.
What an empty, unsatisfying, scary position to be in. If you got nothing but an empty shell that, you know what I mean?
I do, but I think, I don't even blame them. I think our society, we're the ones that, not us,
yes.
but magazines hold them up to this.
We're all part of it.
Yeah.
We're all part of the us, so let's be us.
And you know, and to me, I do feel, for me, my narcissism, I believe, is a result of childhood trauma.
You
know, I think I was raised, I love my family. They are incredibly narcissistic. I grew up not ever feeling seen, not ever feeling like what I did was enough. And I think it created this drive in me. Certainly, it didn't make me an addict, but it definitely exacerbated the feelings I had.
Well, it creates emptiness.
Yeah.
It creates unregulated emotions because unless a parent is there identifying emotions with kids and helping them stay with them as they regulate their emotions, you're left in an unregulated soup. And then you reach outside of your body to try to gain regulation.
Yeah.
And fame, my study shows, is one of the things you reach for to try to fill the void, feel better about the self or have a self.
Yeah.
And then regulate them. At least let the external world fill you so you can regulate and feel better.
Well, first, so I think my first sort of drug or whatever was validation. Which, you know, that's fame is that on a, you know.
Did you ever do theater growing up?
I did. Talent free.
Did the audience that did something for you?
Yeah. Yes. I did ballet from the time I was five. Mm. So I could get in every musical because they always needed people who could dance. Mm. So, yeah. No. And the applause and just attention. For me, it didn't have to be, you know, a full audience. An audience of one was fine as long as I could have the full attention. Mm-hmm, and I see it now as like, I just wanted to be seen, you know? I just wanted...
But not just seen in the sense of seen dancing. You want to be seen your yes. real self.
Oh, I meant by, yeah.
Yeah. And that was the part that was never called out, never identified. You could, probably couldn't even reach it because no one else had seen it.
No, I think I'm now, you know, I'm 12 and a half years sober. I'm just beginning to understand that now.
You know, it's funny. A lot of my friends and peers and patients that have been sober 10 plus years, I've heard a lot of those kinds of comments lately.
It's interesting because it's like, you know, and I think that because I think they're separate. You know, I think the childhood trauma and the seeking validation, it was a messy bowl mm-hmm. of dysfunction for me. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned how to get attention. I learned how I was especially good at getting attention when I was intoxicated, you know, because then I felt the most confident, and especially cocaine. Then it all turned. And, you know, it ended up, you know, the more cocaine I did, the less I was the life of the party. And the more I was home looking through the blinds, wondering, you know, thinking my neighbors had a telescope watching me, you know, jumping every time I heard a noise.
The cocaine paranoia is usually involved people in uniforms.
Mine never did.
Really?
Is that good or bad?
Was there speed maybe in the cocaine you were
no,
doing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I never thought the cops.
No one in a uniform of any kind?
Never. No, it was totally fixated on my neighbors who were not watching me through
a telescope. That's kind of a speed thing. I wonder if they threw some speed into your...
Well, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. The coke that I did, it was... you could actually taste the gasoline in it because it was supposedly carried through,
Doesn't
you know, gasoline.
Doesn't meth sort of taste like that? See what I'm saying?
No, because I tried meth and I hated it. I mean, I who knows, Drew? Who knows what I
right.
was snorting?
That's
but
right.
but it didn't do good things to me.
No, of course
you know?
Not.
And... Yeah, and so basically this was happening at the same time, and I worked at People Magazine, and like I said, I think I thought, wow, you know, I can discover stars before they're stars or whatever it is. And so I would sort of treat People Magazine as like my dating service. I just sort of thought, unbeknownst to my editors, that I would sort of think about, now who do I think would date me? So I'm not going to pitch a story on Brad Pitt or, you know, Matthew McConaughey was becoming really famous then. I'm not going to do that because, like, that's unrealistic. They have supermodels. You know, they're not going to like me. But like, who's an actor who's, like, not that attractive, or maybe he's, like, a character actor where he's just not that famous? And I would literally just sort of try to convince my editors that that's who we needed to profile. Now, every now and then I would be successful in convincing them of that. I would show up to this interview, and it was, again, not formed in my head, but I just think I sort of thought, this person will be able to take me out of my life of pressing like play and record on a recording device and bring me into the world of the people who are saying things that are worth being recorded. You know,
it's a really grandiose thinking.
Really, really grandiose thinking. And of course, it didn't work like that. You know, these people weren't like, oh, you're so fabulous. You know, they were trying to be interviewed, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was an ineffective dating technique.
And then but you did start hanging around with other actors.
Well, what's interesting.
Up-and-comers and stuff.
Well, so I did all that, and it was just really ineffective. And I was fired from People, not for that, just for being sort of a general derelict and a mess. And then I got sober in 2000.
General derelict and a mess.
I deserved to be fired, is what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. It didn't. I mean, it wasn't good. But so I got sober in 2000. And then once I sort of stopped seeking that out as my primary goal, suddenly I was around. You know, that's when I sort of did start to meet and sort of date celebrities or whatever it was. And it was a different form of sort of, you know, abusing myself.
Well, I was going to say that some of the stories you wrote in that article I read were the most disturbing.
You see, that's interesting, see it that way.
Well, because you seemed a little more vulnerable and they seemed a little more abusive.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. See, it made me sad for you. It made me hurt and then angry because the guys – just come on.
It's funny because it's like I want to defend them. Do you really think?
It's just like, ugh.
But okay, let's clarify. They didn't do.
No, nothing horrible. Nothing horrible.
Yeah.
They weren't evil. They weren't horrible. They were just like, it's somehow painful to me to hear people. But they looked ill to me too, by the way. And I feel bad for them.
Yeah.
The guys. They looked ill, like mostly drug addicts, right? Weren't they?
They were.
Or to become.
Yes,
or to
yes,
become.
They
just
were.
They just felt like that to me.
Yeah.
And so I feel bad for them that they were drug addicts. But in the meantime, they were treating you, somebody I kind of care about and worry about,
right.
as someone who –
like a piece of meat kind of that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even a piece of meat, I would feel like, okay. But just like whatever, like the emptiness mm-hmm. of there. The emptiness is even worse than at least they'd be directed if they're treating it like a piece of meat. Do you know what I mean?
But the thing is, and I'm not defending them, but like I was thinking I was the one fetishizing them. It's like in like, OK, one of those experiences, I was sitting at the coffee house, which used to be this place on Sunset where they had meetings. And so tons of sober people would hang out there. And in walks this movie star that I had like had a crush on forever. And, you know, in L.A., we sort of have to act like we're not impressed at all. You know, like I sort of learned along the way that like you're supposed to just be like, oh, hey. I'm serious. So he sits down. And I'm just like, oh, hey, yeah, okay, that's your name? And like acting like I don't know who he is. Do you know what I mean?
They do that in New York too. It's a little bit New York and LA is what that is.
Yeah, but like so he's very friendly and he's friends with a friend of mine. And he says, and I was with a friend. Oh, my God, I was with Jennifer Jimenez.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes,
yes. So, Jennifer Jimenez, if you watch Celebrity Rehab, she was one of our techs there. Somebody I treated years ago.
Yeah.
Were you around when I treated Jennifer?
No, because Jen and I were friends when I first got sober, which was 2000, is when she first got sober.
Okay.
And then she went out.
Yeah.
And is now back. Yes, that's so funny. I was sitting with Jen and a guy we both knew, and then this guy came
in. On one hand, you go, hey, good for you that you went up and talked to this guy you had a crush on.
He came up and talked to us.
Whatever.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
just good for you that you were able to do that. On one hand, it's like, good, that's cool, that's awesome.
Right.
And then he starts – then how he – go ahead, tell
no,
the story.
But okay, you're painting him worse than
maybe. No, I'm sure of that.
Well, so then he says –
because I did feel bad for him too. Go ahead.
So he says, do you guys want to go lie out at the Standard? Because and
man, that's the kind of shit that drives me crazy.
Wait, what?
For people who don't know, Standard is this hotel where there's like this cool pool where
right.
the cool people hang out.
Right.
It's literally like where the cool kids go. And it's such a douche move to say that, really.
Okay. But you have to understand that my heart was just racing and I'm like, oh my God, you know, and I'm acting like, oh sure, the Standard. Yeah. Like as if I every day.
See, for me, like you've gone off the rail then already mm-hmm. into something else because that's not important.
I know.
What's important is who you are as people,
right.
what you're doing, what you're contributing to the world, what are you working on.
And
as opposed to let's go hang out the window.
And yeah. I wish I could tell you that was an isolated experience. And it, you know, I mean, that's the truth. Like, who I – whatever. I was just like, oh, my God, this guy, he wants to hang out with us. So we go to the Standard, the four of us, and we are lying out, and I'm acting like this is all just something I do every day. And at some point he says, hey, what are you guys doing tonight? I'm watching my kid. Do you guys want to come over? And both Jen and the guy had plans. So sort of by process of elimination, it's determined that I'm going to go over there. And – I don't look at it as, oh, God, by process of elimination, he doesn't even care. I look at it like, oh, my God, I'm going over to this guy's house. And I go over and so I drive, you know, gives me his address. I walk in and his kid is like, hi, nice to meet you.
How old?
I think he was about 8. Oh. He goes, hi, nice to meet you. Are you spending the night? First question. And I'm like, first of all, that's sad. Second of all, wow, I'm literally just.
Did you acknowledge it? I mean, did you in your head think, oh, my God, what am I getting myself into? This
yes.
poor kid.
Yes,
okay.
I did.
Okay.
I absolutely did. And I thought that's a really sad thing for an 8-year-old to ask.
Right. Because what I heard the guy asking when he said, want to go with me to watch my kid, whatever, what I hear when that guy asked that is, do you want to have a threesome? That's what I hear him asking.
I think you're making it more nefarious than it was. Honestly, I think that it's telling and interesting that this guy who is, you know, could asked strangers to come over to hang out
around
with his kid.
That's just yeah. bizarre.
Yeah. But, you know, honestly, I looked at it as like a lucky break for me. I'm sorry.
Now I'm sad for you again.
I'm sorry. Well, hey, this was like 8 years ago.
Okay.
If that makes it better.
Yeah, it's better.
I wouldn't look at it that way.
No, I know. So go ahead.
So we watch the kid. So we hang out with the kid and the kid's friend. And I act like I'm just like not wowed at all. And we didn't have sex. We made out. And he said to me, I'd love to go out with you, you know. And I remember that he wrote my number down on a dry erase board where he kept his most important numbers, which is great and ironic. Fabulous detail. And so then he called me.
The irony, right?
I got the irony.
Okay.
My most important numbers for this minute
are on an erase board.
Yes. Yes. It seemed charming to me. You know, when you're writing a story in your head, anything can fit that.
Okay.
So and it's interesting. So then he came and actually met me at a meeting.
So he's a sober guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a 13-step thing too.
I was sober longer than him.
But I'm just saying, I thought it was just he happened to walk into a coffee shop where sober people hang out.
No,
You and he were hanging out after a meeting.
We had not. I had never been to a meeting with him. I've never seen him in a meeting. But yes, that was a factor. And so this is the interesting part, and this is the part that I feel stupid sort of talking about. It's like then he did come and meet me at a meeting that I was at with Jen, and he and I went to dinner, and it was like. Suddenly, all the sort of self-doubt I'd ever had just like was at the forefront of my brain. And I'm thinking, now this guy could be with anybody in the world. He's never going to like me.
You know what's so weird is that that's the moment where something genuine could have actually gone on. Like
yeah.
You could actually like have a talk to this person. He could talk to you. You're having a meal together. You're breaking bread together. And that's where your head got in the way of it.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, I think there were other things in the way of it, namely, like, I don't think he was particularly interested in anything to do with me. I mean, so we sit down and I'm just, my head is going, you know, he could have anyone. He could have people way more beautiful and way younger and way more fabulous. And what do you, and everything I thought to say, my head would go, well, that's a stupid thing. That's this guy. I can't hear that. He's the coolest guy on earth or whatever. And it was just, you know, it was like basically a meal where I had a conversation with myself, beating myself up. And it was suddenly I'm like, I know everything about this person because I've been reading articles about this person since I was, you know, whatever, 15 years old. So I can't really have date conversation. I can't be like, what'd you major in college? Because it's like, who, you know, I know everything. And he didn't ask me anything. And instead, he sort of just starts like drumming on the table. It was weird. It was weird. And I'm just like, oh, my God. You know, and I just felt so uncomfortable. And rather than taking it in like and going, wow, this guy is not asking me anything. He's drumming on the table. I mean, like adults don't do that. Children do that.
This is the stuff in your stories that make me like, ah.
I know. And instead of sort of saying, well, I should, you know, I should get out of here.
Or try to engage in kind of adult conversation.
I tried. I think I definitely tried. I didn't just sit there. I can't sit silent for a second.
Right. But I mean, really try to be vulnerable, reveal something about yourself. You were busy spinning in your head.
Busy thinking I had to put on a show in order to, you know, get love or whatever, validation. And he dropped me off and I just sort of fell into a complete funk afterwards. And I was just like, what's wrong with me? Here was my big shot and I blew it. You know, I know. And it is sad.
And so what do you think about that in retrospect?
I think that my subconscious is a lot smarter than my conscious mind. And I think that basically the reason I felt so uncomfortable is that I wasn't in an environment that was nurturing or safe or anything like that.
Or anything, period.
Yeah. And that rather than...
Well, who was he to you then? What was he?
What do you mean?
Was he a drug?
Yeah.
I mean, you said you're fetishizing him.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I, rather than, you know, I think a lot of people come to LA and they go, oh, I want to be the chosen one. And my thing was, I don't want to be the chosen one. I want to be the chosen one's chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
I want the person who can have anyone to want
me. Seems like that's women do that a lot.
Do you think?
I mean, men aren't apt to do that, are
they? Right. No, I think less. I think less. But I thought it was really interesting. It's like I didn't even have the confidence to think I could be the one, you know?
Yeah. But again, I think because women read these magazines, women do this fantasizing about being the chosen one.
Yeah.
Women do the gossiping about these people.
Yeah. I mean, and
they need to not do that.
I think women.
But there's an important message in here for women, which is be the chosen one. It's okay.
Yeah. And that, like, this, you know, pedestal that we put these famous people on is actually – it's a really dangerous thing. I mean, I felt, you know, in my actual experience how dangerous that was to my own self-esteem and, you know, and to give them so much power. I mean, that's, I think, the hardest part of what I've been through is just, like, giving my power away. You know, forgetting, entirely abandoning myself.
But you were supposed to get the power of the fame back.
It was ironic.
Right?
You
give up your personal power to co-opt the power of the fame, which is fleeting and empty and full of shit.
And meaningless,
yeah. You know, now is a when they measure motivation in kids now internationally. You remember this?
Yeah, it's in your book, right?
Yeah, fame has showed up as an independent. It used to be, you know, I want to have a career, I want to have a family, I want to have a relationship, I want to have money, whatever. Now fame shows up on all the measures. I want to be famous.
Well, and also, I feel like this. I got this from your book. Like this was back when Paris Hilton was a big thing. When they asked them, who would you want to most have dinner with? And it was sort of like Barack Obama, you know, got maybe like 10% and Paris Hilton got 90% or something in some study.
What is it that women do with other women that are famous?
It's interesting, you know, because that was part of my thing is I was like, maybe I just need a celebrity gal pal.
Well, I was going to say, again, as opposed and women that become famous, are they going for something particular? But let's talk first about women that want to be around the famous gal pal.
Yeah. I mean, well, because when I first moved to LA, I knew this girl who she was the second assistant to a celebrity. Okay. I watched that girl campaign for the first assistant's job, get the job, become that celebrity's producing partner, produce 10 movies or something. And now she's married to an even more famous person. Hmm. And I used to go, what does she do? How does she have the skill? And it's a skill I definitely do not have, this sort of ability to kind of put your needs second, to sort of.
But that's a different move, isn't it, than being just the relationship with a famous person? Because that person had business goals.
Yeah.
I want to access that power so I can parlay it into business.
Yeah.
That's a little different.
It is.
Very few people pull that one off.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing. But yeah, no, I think the people, you know, that sort of befriend females. I mean, they just, I think, are sort of very good at being a support system, very good at sort of, you know, disregarding their own needs, at sort of being subservient.
Basking in the narcissistic glow, we call that.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah. And honestly, I just think that I was too narcissistic to be able to do that. I literally, you know, would try. I would be around female celebrities and be like, oh, maybe I can be their gal pal. But I was just too into talking and my own agenda or whatever it was.
And now you're 8 years, 10 years, 12 years recovery.
12 and a half years, yeah.
12 years in recovery. And you were just saying that the narcissism or – and we're tossing that term around.
Right.
I'm not sure it's a fair term to use because all addicts have a certain amount of narcissism. All of us these days have some of these qualities going on.
Right.
I think it's – when you talk about it getting better, what is it that's getting better?
Well, yeah, and I do want to – because narcissistic personality disorder is not a disorder I have.
No.
And I do agree. It's
thrown
traits.
Around. It's traits, yeah.
Yeah, I mean self-obsession might be a more
– Well, I was thinking that, but I don't think that's quite right either because the emptiness that we're talking about is a part of narcissistic injuries.
Right.
Which you started talking about at the beginning too. Been, you know, not having your needs met, not being identified, your genuine – maybe a better way to put it is talk about your genuine sense of self has been diminished, marginalized.
Right.
And is it now coming forward?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't think I had any sense of self. I don't think
right.
I had any ability to understand.
So if you have no sense of self, why not fill it with something bigger than life?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I understand the choices I made and I have empathy for it. And I don't see how it could have gone any other way in a way. Mm. And you know, I didn't understand. My parents are very, very much like you, not even like you will believe this. There's no room for, you know, personal choice or personal thoughts.
Believe this meaning
whatever it is they believe.
Politics, anything.
Anything.
Sense of the world, people, whatever.
Anything. I mean, there is no diverging from the stories
begs
they
an alternative.
Tell. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just doing what they were raised to do.
Right.
It's not their fault.
But then when you step up and go, hang on here, I'm not sure, I don't feel that way, doesn't matter.
Doesn't
your
matter.
Your feelings don't matter. Your point of view doesn't
and
matter.
And I was really very much shamed for, you know, and you know, and I always said, I want to be a writer. It's all I ever want to do. And I was just like, told, no, you're going to go to law school. You're going to go to business school. You can't be a writer. And, you know, and even when I started and I started to make a living at it, I was sort of sent a lot of articles about how writers never make it.
It's almost comical.
And even still, I remember once I'd sold, I think I had 3 books out. And I remember saying to my dad, you know, I sort of was like, well, so you can stop that train of thought or whatever. I've made it. And he's like, well, it sure took you long enough. And, you know, and even still, when my dad and I talked last year, I said, remember how you kept telling me, like, I should be a lawyer? Like, now I have 5 books out. And he's like, well, you would have made more money as a lawyer. So I mean, that's just
begs
sort of
point of view. Begs no alternative. Can you talk about the book you just worked on?
Yeah. Well, oh, which one? The Sizemore book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah. So right now I have out the Kindle single, They Like Me, They Really Like Me, which is all about this celebrity.
And that's what we're talking about here. It is a book that you sent me what? A chapter or something?
No,
what was
that's
it?
The whole thing. It's a Kindle single. So it's these things that Amazon is doing directly.
I recommend it highly then. I've read it. I recommend it.
You've read the whole thing.
And I had an emotional reaction to it. And I called Anne. I said, I'm reacting to this. I need to talk to you.
I know. You scared me. I was like, what
do
you mean?
No, I just had a reaction. And we sorted it out and I figured out what I was reacting to. And then I said, now you got to come to a podcast. But also, Anna wrote a book called Party Girl, which is one of the best recovery books I've ever read. Yeah, that was really a good book. So I do recommend that. She also has Bought, Reality Matters, Falling for Me, Animal Attraction. What's that one?
That was a Kindle single as well. It's about how obsessed I am with my cats, basically.
So you can get these at drdrew.com with a click through to Amazon. Is that how it works?
Right. And we'll also link to them on our episode page, too.
Okay, perfect. So we'll link to these, all the Kindle books and the other, and you can put the other books up, too, as well. They're good.
Thank you. And well, yes, the Sizemore book is actually coming out next month.
So tell us what that experience was like.
Okay. So Tom Sizemore, a man you know well, I wrote his autobiography. And so that means that I spent...
How did you get selected for that?
I did a story on Tom, you know, because I freelance write. I write for a lot of magazines. And the Daily Beast assigned me a story on Tom Sizemore's comeback. And it was maybe 6 months after he'd been on Celebrity Rehab. And he was getting a ton of work. And I just took the assignment. My editor said, write about Tom Sizemore's comeback. I was living in New York at the time. I, you know, got on the phone with him and he was an amazing interview. I mean, you know what he's like.
He's phenomenal.
And, you know, he's crying, he's weeping, you know, this interview is going places like I never had a phone interview go. So the story comes out and it got a lot of pickup and he really credited me with like his comeback or whatever. When I was simply the writer that had been assigned to do a job. And then this website, The Fix, launched. And that was a website that I was working for 2 years. So I was their first employee and I just left 3 weeks ago. And when The Fix was launching, I had to get celebrity interviews. And so I emailed his manager and I said, oh, can we do an interview for this? So that's when I go to meet him in person. And Tom is really literary. And he was so impressed that I had actually published books that he went and read Party Girl. I think he'd read it by the time I interviewed him. And he said, you're a fantastic writer. Will you write my book? And that was how it happened. So
he is very literary. He was a Shakespearean actor.
And he can quote.
He'll do Iago from beginning to end.
But I mean,
without taking a breath.
And he can quote Martin Amis know. And I think that people have no idea.
No. It's very hard to see that in him, especially when he was deep in his disease. Like, Tom, dude.
Yeah.
But he is extremely bright man.
Yeah. And he has a master's. Yep. And so anyway, so we did the proposal. We sold it to Simon & Schuster. And then we spent a somewhat torturous year working together on it. And now it's coming out. And apparently people are super excited. He's going to go on Dr. Phil, you know, and The View and everything.
Good.
So, yeah.
Good.
And it's a great book, and it's called By Some Miracle, I Made It Out of Here.
How deep does he get into his disease?
Oh, Drew, you're going to like this book. I mean—
Listen, I was—
You lived it.
I walked into some of those rooms to try to get him out.
Yeah.
And literally there was one point, Bob and I— You should have called me so I could describe it to you. I don't think he can describe
what
he was
living
in.
When you guys were giving him the pizzas to try, and that's how—
It was that whole area.
And he was living in that house in the hills.
Squalor.
Yeah.
Squalor.
With like the gas smell. I mean, I heard about it.
I mean, dirt on the floor, like literally like somebody had like a mudslide had happened in the house. It was unbelievable. And he, I hope he doesn't mind me talking about
this. No, I'm sure he wouldn't.
Bob and I went to try to retrieve him because he was just not in his right head.
Yeah.
And he barricaded himself in his bathroom. We were in his bedroom going, come on, Tom, come on, dude. This isn't right. You got to get out. And we heard this bellowing out of there. And both of us simultaneously started like backing out of the bedroom And I didn't talk to him about it until like a couple weeks later. And I said, you remember when Tom was in that room? I go, and he goes, yeah, I thought for sure he was going to throw open the door with a shotgun. I go, so did I.
Right.
We had the exact same fantasy at the exact same moment because he was way out on meth that he was going to throw open the door with a rifle.
Right.
Because he was so violent and so far gone and so in the meth psychosis. Poor guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He came out. And, but for the grace of God, we got him back.
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
I mean, and you know that he said over and over again that like nothing worked. I don't know how many rehabs he'd been to. How many times you'd treated him.
We had treated him twice before. Whenever Bob and I got him, though, he did well.
Right.
And he and I, for some reason, Bob and I could double team him. We just had his number and we both loved the guy. And so
yeah.
we just knew we could get him if we had him long enough.
And he used to buy drugs from Bob. He'd known Bob a long time.
I hear that. So Bob gives me those stories all the time. He goes, oh, yeah, I used to buy. I was like, why did you tell me that? We've been working with the guy for 3 years. Why didn't
right.
you mention that you used to run drugs with him?
He really looks up to Bob,
yeah.
you know,
I know,
and you.
I know.
And, you know, and he would tell me, you know, he's like, the last thing I ever expected was to get sober on television.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that did it for him.
Weird.
Yeah.
I'm so thankful.
Yeah.
So thankful. Did you ever interview Jennifer Jimenez about this?
You know what? I tried. Jen and I never connected about it, but I know that they went through treatment together.
Yes.
You treated them
well,
together.
Bob and I had the inpatient program, and then there was like a residential program where we'd kind of send people to, but
right.
we didn't have control over that at that point in time.
And it was chaos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard about it.
And so we would get them stabilized and go, can I go to residential? And the two of them, woo, oh my God.
Yeah.
And we brought Jen back and got her squared, and Tom, we lost.
Right.
That was like 15 years ago, something like that. 12 years ago.
Yeah. So as you know, I haven't talked to him this year. Like, you know, as far as I know, all is well. The crazy thing is I'm getting – I'm at UCLA mm-hmm. because I'm getting KDAC certified.
Congratulations.
To become a drug and alcohol mm-hmm. counselor, even though I'm not going to actually be a counselor.
Yeah, I get it.
Just – and guess who's my buddy in class?
Ricky Rackman.
Yes. And guess who else?
Who?
Paul Sizemore, Tom's brother.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
So it's – yeah, it's really – and what's funny is he wouldn't cooperate for the book. He didn't call me back.
Yeah.
And so now he's living immense as he has to sit next to me
oh,
in class
funny.
Every week. He's great. I love him.
I feel so relieved for his mom, Judy. Did you talk to Judy?
I did.
She suffered through their disease a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she really was freaked out. She would never go to Al-Anon. She would
yeah.
never go. But she was so, so distraught.
Yeah.
Reasonably so.
Yeah. Reasons. So, and that was interesting. I mean, I sort of had never imagined myself being like a ghostwriter or doing anything like that. But Tom's story was interesting enough that it was a great opportunity.
All right. We got to take a break. You got to be out of here at 1 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. So we got to make a break, go to calls. Anna David here. Again, They Like Me, They Really Like Me is the Kindle single. Go check it out. We have a link on our website, annadavid.com, Twitter, @AnnaDavid. Be right back.
Hi, I'm Larry Miller, but in a way, aren't we all? And this week, on This Week with Larry Miller, we talk about St. Patrick's Day. We talk about the poetry and the essays and the great writing, and maybe a little to do with the bars and pubs. But you know what? It's very meaningful after you've done something. Tune us in, and we think you'll agree. We'll see you here.
Welcome back. It's Dr. Drew Podcast. Anna David joins me, and we're going to take your calls right now. Let's see here. Okay, let us go to Roger. He's in Seattle. Roger, what's up?
Hey, Dr. Drew. My wife's on fentanyl patches. Mm-hmm. She's chronic, we'll call it chronic pain.
Yep.
Been on them a long time, and I think they're starting to take her away, and I want to know, should she be off of these things?
What's her pain?
Fibromyalgia.
I'm of the opinion that opiates should never be used for fibromyalgia. And the reality is, unfortunately, that although opiates are prescribed for chronic pain routinely, there's actually no scientific evidence that they do anything for a chronic pain. And yet it's routinely done. And as Anna and I, you and I know, people that want to be on opiates chronically typically are addicts. Typically. I'm not saying she is necessarily, Roger, but typically, because I wouldn't want to be on opiates. I don't like how I feel on opiates.
Unfortunately, I do like how I feel on opiates.
Right.
But I have a question. I mean, it does relieve the pain, though. An opiate relieves the pain.
An opiate, acute pain. Acute pain, it works beautifully.
Right.
Chronic pain, it probably intensifies it in most cases, something called hyperalgesia. And it, not only does it intensify the pain, it intensifies the affective component of pain. So the distress that pain causes us, the misery it causes us, goes up from opiates. And when you also have a drive system, meaning a distorted motivation, i.e. addiction, now it's game on. Because the brain is saying, do this or you're going to die, and you're in distress, so you got to keep doing it.
Right, right.
It's very hard to stop. It's very, and sometimes you would just say, just leave them on it. I mean, that you might. I mean, because if somebody's 60 years old and in pain and sort of okay with it and doesn't really have any, you know, doesn't mind being on the couch a lot of the time and the family's okay with how they are, I mean, you might choose to do that. It's a philosophical question at a certain point.
Well,
go ahead.
No, I just – when I was at The Fix, I edited a story on a girl who went on fentanyl patches for fun, and just the way she described that high, you know,
intense.
The intensity.
Well, then people end up breaking them and eating them and all kinds
and
of
And the lollipops.
Shit. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Now, as you increase the dosages, what starts to happen?
You start getting more checked out and more lethargic and more on the couch and more – disconnected, and you may have more labile mood because the pharmacology is going up and down a little more fiercely. That's why they use the long-acting stuff to try to prevent that from happening. It's a very, very, very controversial, very challenging, very difficult problem. Just the one thing I would say, though, that I find fascinating is if this were a 35-year-old physician, you would always go for abstinence. Always. Always for our peers, and yet our patients, something different. Interesting. Oh, well.
And is this something where when you talk about you have to go, it's going to be a hellish 5 days?
Oh, yeah. It'll be a bad 5 days. And then again, you still have whatever underlying problem is there, the fibromyalgia, whatever else causing
right.
the pain. And people are sometimes unwilling. They just won't. I mean, it's hard enough just to deal with the addiction part. You superimpose pain. They just that's it. I'd rather just sort of be at pasture.
Right.
Be okay right now. It's really hard.
Right. It'd
be, that's you know, I started studying philosophy a few years ago just because of these challenges. You know, when you really have to get philosophical about it, it's like, yes, I want everyone to have a thriving, flourishing, complete abstinent recovery. I want that for everybody.
Right.
But sometimes maybe that's not the best thing. Sometimes that's dangerous. It's hard. I try not to treat those things because I'm so enthusiastic about people that want recovery.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but what about also that thing that you mentioned that you heard at a conference about people with chronic pain?
Oh, yeah, people with chronic pain. It was a conference I was at several years ago, and I was looking at some stuff just recently to see if I could find that data
I
again.
Looked for it everywhere.
It's not out there
yeah.
now. But a guy got up. I swear to God is my witness, it was back when the California first started having requirements for physicians to have chronic pain and end-of-life CME, continuing medical education. And one of the first lectures, a guy stands up and goes, about 96% of chronic pain patients have sexual or physical abuse, trauma survivors. Anyway, it's on to the opiates. How do we prescribe the opiates for chronic pain? No, zero commentary about
That's
what to
crazy.
Do with that. It was fascinating. All right, let's keep going here with questions. Let's go to – this is John. John, what's up?
Hey, Dr. Drew. First, I want to give Anna a compliment. Her book, Party Girl, along with Corin Zilkus' Smashed are two of my – favorite books on addiction and recovery.
I'm not surprised. Party Girl was really good. Thank
John,
you, John.
John and Drew, call me every day. Thank you so much.
You're
she
welcome.
Still has those narcissistic residual. You got to keep her filled up.
Yeah, give me more.
You're right. I'll feed that all day if you want. So I'm calling because I got a phone call from my mom last night. Last fall, she gave a kidney to her uncle, and she heard from him, her uncle, that his son has been an alcoholic for a long time, lost his job because of the alcoholism, went on a terrific bender, did some real physical damage to himself. In terms, I think he said like 15% liver function or something awful like that. And they've got him dry, but he was refusing any kind of treatment, and they think it's because he wants to die. He knows he's dying, and he's so sufficiently depressed that he wants to die. And so my question was, if they can get him in a sort of clear enough moment that he would assent to some treatment, how does one find a recovery center? He's in Southern California in Orange County. How does one find a recovery center that can deal with the physiological issues, the psychological issues, and the addiction issues? Because if he's going to get any help and not die, you know, all three of those are going to have to get handled at once.
Any good program, these are not uncommon presentations. Somebody who's got severe advanced medical problems and who is profoundly depressed, that is late-stage alcoholism. That's just the way it is. That's the way it always is. So anybody that's equipped to deal with alcoholics typically has the resources to deal with that. It usually has to be associated with a medical or a psychiatric hospital or both, at least for initial, you know, the initial stabilization process. But to say, you know, an alcoholic wants to die, that's a lot of them. A lot of them have, if not active, certainly passive suicidal ideation.
And most a lot of the big treatment centers, the Promises, the Circle Lodges, and all of those, they have full medical facilities, even though they're
absolutely
not attached to hospitals.
Right. I mean, you know, Betty Ford would be a perfect place for him because they're attached to a hospital. Where does he live? What area?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head. I know they're in Orange County.
Well, I was just thinking the Mission Hospital down there in Laguna Beach has a place. Hogue has a place. Northbound is a residential program to follow. And there's a lot of resources in Orange County. And I'm not sure if I misheard, but I didn't sound like anything out of the ordinary for significant alcoholism. They're typically, you know, liver disease with concomitant medical problems, severe depression or bipolar or appearing that way,
right,
and need you know, withdrawal from alcohol. I always say this and people are always surprised that alcohol withdrawal is the one withdrawal that is commonly fatal.
Yeah, you know. Heroin not.
Not heroin not. Benzos can be a little rough, but heroin not. Opiates not. Very miserable, but not fatal. Alcohol fatal.
And the truth is, in terms of the depression and wanting to die, I mean, it is true. I think that's the jumping off point. I think that is the state you have to get to in order to get help is, I want to die. What are the options?
Yeah. So, John, go ahead.
They don't have very much money, and I've heard you say a few times that, you know, you call these places and they want to help and they can find ways to work things out. How would one present that? You know, if you're calling one of these places and saying, hey, we really want to get this person help. Right now they're willing to go in, but we don't have a lot of money. How do you present that?
You present it just like that. Almost every case is that way these days. I don't have insurance, or my insurance is highly restrictive. I mean, that is the number one management issue that any program is dealing with. We're all dealing with that because even when you have insurance, it's never adequate for dealing with the disease.
But I think that's going to change, supposedly, in Obamacare next year.
I'll believe it when I see it. And the same thing with the bullshit about, oh, we're going to support primary care. Been hearing that crap my entire career, and it only gets worse and worse and worse. I'm sick of it. These are the big problems in our time, and no one is throwing the right resources in the right direction. Why? Because they're not fancy operations, and they're painful, and they're difficult, and they have bad outcomes. But laser surgery, we'll take care of that.
Right.
We'll take care of that. All right. Well, so listen, John, good luck with that. Let us know how it works out, okay?
Thanks so much.
All right, buddy. Good. Well, let's go to Mike. What's up, Mike?
Dr. Drew, Anna, how you doing? Good to talk to you both.
You too.
Yeah.
Big fan of the show. And Dr. Drew, I had a question for you. Basically, I'm trying to look for some professional help with, I guess it would be a mental health problem. I'm a young guy. I'm 28, a young professional. And unfortunately, I've been kind of a product of the internet pornography boom that we've had.
Yeah.
And I got exposed to that, you know, at a very young age. And it's something that I've been struggling with for quite a long time.
Very common.
I've been married for 3 years with my wife for 10, and over the past year and a half, you know, it's become a very important issue in our marriage that I stop. My wife considers looking at pornography, cheating, even fantasizing about somebody else, a past partner, in her mind is cheating.
Well, that's ridiculous. Okay,
well,
but that's okay. That's her feeling.
That's okay. That's what she's feeling. So I've tried to get therapy for this. I've talked to psychiatrists, I've gone to psychologists, I've gone to PsyDs, and I've gone to LCSWs. And I've had a hard time finding somebody who will both give me some individual therapy and work as a couple.
Yeah.
I've actually gone to a clinical sex therapist with my wife, who are also marriage counselors. And basically, I walked in and met with these people, and they said, well, your wife called up. She said that you're a sex addict, and we are going to have to talk about that. And so when I give them my behaviors, they kind of look at me like I've got two heads, like, I don't see a sexual addiction problem here. This is a relationship problem. And my wife is just convinced that I'm a sex addict, that because I can't give it up.
How much? I kind of agree with them, Mike. I got to say, but how much are you doing?
This right now has been maybe once a week, maybe once every other week.
Sex addiction is a real loss of control. I mean, you have to have – I understand it's a behavior you'd like to stop, but
right.
I'm not sure it's under the heading of addiction per se. Did you ever go to 12-step meetings?
I've never been to a 12-step meeting, and I understand it's not the frequency, but it feels like
– I understand the consequences. I get it. I'm listening.
Right.
I'm not closing the door, but I'm just saying I understand why they would say that kind of thing. And when it comes to, you know, controlling compulsive behaviors that people want to stop – 12-step meetings has typically got to be part of it. I mean, that's – did you ever go to the website sash.net, S-A-S-H.net?
I believe I've heard you mention it. I'm not sure if they're active in my area.
Why don't you at least take some of the screening instruments there? It's now up on the website here. There's a whole I'm looking at the front page. It says, am I a sex addict? Click here. There are screening tools to decide, do I have a problem or don't I, and see if you meet formal criteria.
Right.
I mean, that might at least show your wife that if there's an issue. And it does sound like there's a real significant interpersonal problem. I'm stunned that you've had so much work or tried so much to reach out so much for help and no one's been able to really be effective. That's kind of
unless it is really he is not a sex addict.
Well, but
and so
even then you would think somebody skilled could help
would
them.
Would say, let's talk about the relationship.
Or do something to help them.
And part of the problem is that whenever we have a clinician who says that, then my wife is of the opinion that this person isn't in what they're talking about.
Well, go print out a screening test and take it and see what you get. And if you don't meet criteria in a formal screen, then she can go, well, what are you supposed to do when you don't meet criteria for a condition that she's not a clinician, she's not in a position to make a diagnosis. Maybe there's something going on here, but that ain't
right.
it.
Well, and addiction is self-diagnosed. I mean, I realize that denial is a factor, but we really don't go around calling people addicts, even wives. I mean, don't you agree with that, Drew? That it's self. I mean, that's the big 12-step philosophy.
That you have to die. You have to admit to it yourself.
Yeah, it's a self-diagnosed thing. I can't decide because of how someone drinks that they're alcoholic.
Well, I as a clinician, I can.
It's different.
Yeah, it's different for me.
You got an MD.
But by the same token. I wouldn't do it for myself, and I wouldn't do it for my wife, and a wife shouldn't be doing that for a husband. You need an objective clinician to make the diagnosis. And I don't know, Mike. It sounds very, very challenging. But go to the website, fill out the screening instrument. Let me know what you find out when I'm back on the air. I think it'll be Thursday next week, and I'll be interested to hear what comes of that. The great Anna David is here. We have to say goodbye to her. The Kindle single is They Like Me, They Really Like Me, and we really like her here. We'll have to have her back again sometime soon. The website is annadavid.com, and Anna David is the Twitter. Check out Party Girl and check out the new Tom Sizemore biography called...
By some miracle, I made it out of there. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here. It was really interesting. See you guys next time. Oh, follow the podcast. Follow us at Dr. Drew Podcast for call-in times to follow up with us and to be here for phone calls and take your problems. Talk to you soon.
This is Corolla Digital.